We may begin with an exercise which our human I am is not likely to object to, and which it is even likely to find pleasing, at any rate in the early stages. We do so by recalling the Lord's invitation to seek his rest. Come unto me, all you that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. We recall whatever in our life causes us most anxiety or pain, so that we may find rest or relief from these our heaviest burdens. We find that rest or relief, of course, only in the degree that we put on Christ, in the words of St. Paul, in the degree that we put on the all-consciousness of the divine I am. The mere recollection of our burdens in such a context may bring instant relief, or it may not. The burdens may be of such a kind, perhaps of a painful or shameful kind, that a considerable effort will be needed to recollect them clearly. Perhaps it will help us here to recall the commoner human attempts to cope with burdens. Some of us try to suppress them, others seek distraction from them, others try to argue themselves into ignoring them. These and other habitual attempts to cope with burdens by avoiding them in any way, which most of us no doubt begin by making, may well prevent us from clearly recollecting them. We may therefore have to force ourselves to do so at first, even at the cost of pain. For in no other way can they be truly shed. If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us, says St. John. This recollection is necessary psychologically, not only spiritually. Why is an attempt to avoid any burden by driving it from consciousness hopeless? Very simply, because the emotional content of the burden originates from subconsciousness, and driving it out only ensures that the burden will crop up again later in another form, at perhaps a highly inconvenient moment, and possibly therefore in a more painful manner. If the burden reappears in some disguised form, and is therefore not recognized, it may well seem a new and wholly gratuitous addition to life's difficulties, and it may yield its disguise only to expert and possibly prolonged analysis, by which time the sufferer may have become not merely burdened, but pathological. It is therefore necessary, for all reasons, to make a real effort to bring all our burdens into the full light of consciousness, face them resolutely, and thoroughly accept them. Yes, there it is, the ineluctable fact that I dread losing my beloved, my reputation, my money in that venture. But I acknowledge and accept that dread. It may even be necessary to grope about in the shadows of half-consciousness for any burdens that may have been poked away there in the course of trying to shed them. But we must guard against overdoing this cathartic self-analysis. We must not allow the mind to ramble introspectively into too much detail, or our attention may be altogether sidetracked from the next, the positive step of trying to know divine peace, sidetracked into an endless labyrinth of worries, anxieties, resentments, and other painful emotions. We should form the habit of quickly and resolutely recollecting whatever troubles us most heavily, only pausing long enough to bring the burden out of the semi-conscious depths of the mind, and then firmly stop. 2 minutes should be enough for this stage. We then pass on to the next, the positive step, in which we seek to receive Christ's rest or peace. That is to say, in which we begin trying to know, experience, feel ourselves dwelling in the supremely restful and peaceful state, which is the particular facet of the all-conscious divine I am we are trying to realize at the moment. And so we begin to rest, dwell, or abide in Christ, and he in us. As we do so, the contrast between our fallen, human, self-conscious condition and the supreme, divine, all-conscious state stands out in sharp relief. Our human I am, composed of its needs, desires or aversions, strivings and pleasures or pains, stands out in sharp relief against the indestructible, immutable, impassible divine I am. And then, perhaps for the first time in our life, we realize something of the immeasurable abyss between the squalor of human nature and the splendor of the divine nature and life. This experience of the contrast is the first soft, gentle, disguised death blow to our human I am. For we see it, perhaps for the first time in our life, in a convincingly unfavorable light. We begin to know ourselves, however dimly, even as we are known. We now come to the actual attempt to feel ourselves in the divine I am's peace and his peace in us. The moment we try to do this, however, we realize how completely strange even this facet of I am, which is probably nearer to human experience than any other, is to us. What is divine peace like? How are we to begin trying to experience a peace which really is divine and not merely human peace writ large, merely the peace of this world? It now becomes obvious that we must put off trying to feel divine peace until our notion, our mental picture of it, is a little clearer. We must ensure, in fact, that we know at least something of divine peace with the mind before plunging into an attempt to know it with the heart. Otherwise, we are in danger of self-delusion, of imagining ourselves feeling divine peace, when we are feeling merely the peace of the world. So let us now turn very briefly to consider divine peace. Being a facet of the divine nature and life, it is ineffable, and therefore there is not much that can be said about it. Precisely because it is a facet of the divine I am, however, we can perfectly safely say that it cannot be negative, a mere absence of anything. For it is part of the very substance, the very stuff of reality. Divine peace cannot therefore be negative, any more than light can be truly described as a negation of darkness. Nor can divine peace be in the least precarious, for there are no circumstances upon which its existence could possibly depend, or by which it could possibly be shattered. Least of all can it be liable to decay, for it is a quality, an attribute, a facet of the divine nature and life, and is therefore eternal, perfect, absolute. Concentrating on divine peace cuts the notion so deeply into the mind as to cause changes, not only in the mind, but throughout the whole personality. The feeling enshrined in the notion involuntarily becomes absorbed into that sum total of thinking, feeling, and striving, which we call our self, our human I am, and thus inevitably brings about changes in the latter's whole structure. It therefore matters profoundly that our notion of divine peace should be as true as we can make it at this stage. Thus it matters a great deal exactly how we formulate the notion. It matters exactly what words or phrases we hold in the mind with a view to experiencing their meaning more deeply. To be quite precise, in trying to know divine peace as deeply as we can, that is with mind and heart, as well as with the will, as we shall soon see, it is extremely important to select a word or a phrase which expresses this attribute of the divine I am most accurately and completely. By far the safest course for the beginner is to concentrate upon some phrase used by the Lord himself as recorded in the Gospels. This is far safer than using some phrase composed by oneself, which after all merely expresses our own notion, however erudite. There is no more fully expressive phrase than the one recorded in the Gospel according to St. John, in which the Lord gives his peace to his disciples. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. St. John's Gospel, chapter 14. As we shall see, we may shorten or adapt the phrase to suit our particular needs later on. But not at the start, when we are trying to express the notion of divine peace as clearly and as accurately as possible. The safest and most effective way of feeling divine peace is to repeat the Lord's actual words over and over again, letting them dwell in us richly, concentrating upon their sense and trying to feel their meaning as deeply as possible. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. In this way, we not only let these words dwell in us richly, but behold or contemplate the facet of the divine glory which they represent. That facet, divine peace, is thus imprinted upon us, and to that extent we begin to be changed into the likeness of the divine I am. To that extent, Christ, the divine I am, is born in us. Concentration is likely to be extremely difficult at first. Our attention will constantly wander. Hence we may have to repeat the sentence aloud at first, until the wandering, distracted mind grows still and becomes fixed upon the words. Even if this fails, it may help to begin by first repeating a slight variant of the 10th verse of the 46th Psalm. Be still then, and know my peace. As though the divine I am was speaking to us, stilling the chaos of our minds. Be still. Be still. Be still and know my peace. Know that I am peace. Then, as the mind gradually grows still, we should return to the original sentence and resume the attempt to receive the divine peace enshrined in the words, repeating them over and over again to keep the mind from wandering to other thoughts. We may as well face the fact that however hard we try, our attention will constantly wander. The very meaning of the Lord's words will stimulate thoughts about them. These thoughts must be suppressed. For we are trying to put on the divine I am, not exercising our own human I am's power of thought. Our thoughts will wander even while we are actually repeating the Lord's words to ourselves, Nevertheless, something of their meaning will sink into our mind and heart, even while our attention wanders. With practice, this wandering is usually found to diminish, and the meaning then sinks in proportionately deeply. Some find it useful to get into the way of repeating the sentence as they breathe in, and of feeling the divine peace it enshrines as they breathe out. As soon as the attention has become fixed upon the sentence, at any rate to some extent, it becomes profitable to shorten it. We may otherwise find ourselves concentrating upon repeating the sentence correctly, rather than upon experiencing its meaning. This can be done without much risk of distortion if we remember its essence. Important as the actual words may be, they are, after all, only symbols of the divine peace which streams forth from the divine I Am as part of his glory which in his supreme love he eternally gives to all creation. The essence of the sentence is thus very easily discovered. My peace I give unto you. These words express the gift of divine peace to us as accurately as the longer sentence. The question now arises, for how long should we behold or contemplate divine peace? Everyone must decide this individually, having regard to the aim of the exercise. This is to experience divine peace as deeply as possible, so as to believe as deeply as possible that we have received it, and so to receive it as deeply as possible. Length of time does not, of course, necessarily yield depth of experience. The beginner will usually be best advised not to contemplate longer than 5 minutes twice a day at first, gradually prolonging the period to 10 minutes as capacity grows. But overlong contemplation is apt to defeat its own purpose, rather as overdoing any physical exercise defeats its own purpose. 2 short periods a day, during which the effort to concentrate is faithfully maintained, are far more useful than a single long one. Each period should always end with a few words of thanksgiving and self-oblation. We thank thee, O Lord, for thy peace, and we offer and present unto thee, as far as we are able, all that we are, all that we do, and all that we have. Although this is given little space here, it must not be regarded as anything but essential, for without this ending to each contemplation, we are in danger of drifting into a confusion of ourselves with God, of our human I Am with the divine I Am, which is spiritual death. But our knowledge of divine peace, and to that extent of the divine I Am, is still not as deep as it may be, even at the level we are aiming to reach at the present stage. It has still not touched all the 3 sides of our personality. We have begun knowing divine peace with the mind and begun carrying that knowledge down into the heart. But the will still remains untouched by that knowledge. And without this, the whole striving, conative, active side of our personality is not directly touched by divine peace. Hence our belief in having received peace and our actual reception of peace remains correspondingly incomplete. The whole notion of will knowledge may seem strange. The need to know peace not only with the mind but with the heart is intelligible enough. But in what normal sense can one know peace with the will? Let us begin by reminding ourselves of the difference between knowing peace with the mind and knowing it with the heart. One may call the first a notion about peace, and the second an experience of peace. In the second case, the knowledge may be said to have sunk far enough down to tinge that much more of the thinking, feeling, striving unity which we call our human I am. One may say that a degree of divine peace, by taking root in our heart, has to that extent brought about our transformation. But the third great side of our personality still remains untouched thereby. The process now requires to be taken on down into the will, so that the knowledge begins to tinge not only the feeling, but the whole striving side of our personality as well. It is only then that divine peace becomes truly incarnate in our personality. In the degree, of course, that it is possible at such an early stage, in the degree, to be exact, in which it has been grasped by our mind. This may all sound quite reasonable, but if this cassette is as practical as it claims to be, the question originally asked still remains to be answered. In what normal sense can we know divine peace with the will? The answer is really quite simple, provided we draw on our everyday experience. We know peace with the will when we cease to be content with merely knowing about it, with merely feeling it, but actually are divinely peaceful and act accordingly, and actually bring or give peace to all around. A moment's reflection will reveal that knowledge in any sphere is incomplete until this stage is reached. A knowledge of love is incomplete, for instance, until we not only know about it, not only experience it, but actually give love to our beloved. This is the fruition, completion, culmination of knowledge in which it reproduces itself and thus truly lives, thus truly is, has real being. Having now made clear in what sense divine peace may be known with the will, we come to the most practical question of all. How do we actually come to that knowledge? One simple way of working for this knowledge is to modify the method of contemplating divine peace already outlined and to extend it to practical life. We saw in the previous section that at least two periods each day should be spent in becoming still and trying to feel divine peace as deeply as possible. The experience gained in this way must now be harnessed to a watchword, as it were, and applied to everyday life. The watchword, which should be as short as possible, is then set up at the back of the mind, ready for use whenever necessary during the day. So our watchword in this case could be divine peace, or perhaps better still, my peace. The simplest and clearest way of describing its use is with a couple of simple examples. The first is set in one of the many periods during the day when the consciousness is not fully occupied with any specific task. We are either merely idling in waiting for the next job to be done, or are occupied with some quite mechanical work. As often happens at such times, some anxiety or resentment suddenly floats up from the subconsciousness. We are tempted, from force of habit, to send this unwelcome ingredient of our human I am back where it came from. But we remember that this merely ensures its reappearance at some other time, and that it can only be permanently purged or washed away by divine peace. we recall the watchword, my peace. And we plunge this right into the midst of the anxious or resentful thought, as water is flung on a rag that has caught fire, allowing all our experience of divine peace to flood over and smother every other feeling, if possible, obliterating the whole human I am. The second example is set in a situation in which some emotion is aroused by some external stimulus. Suppose we find ourselves offensively treated. The impulse wells up to put the aggressor in his place. But we manage to recall the watchword, my peace. The beginner is hardly likely to feel divine peace in the same degree that he has known it in the stillness of contemplation. He may not succeed in feeling it at all, but if he continues using his will to keep the watchword in his mind, he is gaining a great deal. First, his normal human reaction fails to materialize, or at any rate is much weakened. Next, he is reminded of the eternal reality. He comes to remember ever more distinctly that the divine I am, the eternal reality, is above all, and through all, and in all, and therefore in him too. The divine I am remains eternally impassible, eternally pouring out his peace upon all creation in boundless fullness. With this, the incipient human reaction begins to die, and the vacuum begins to be filled with divine peace. Here, the very first faltering step in the transformation of the human into the divine actually begins. The divine feeling, having taken the place of a human emotion, seeks expression in action, and the contemplative, having received peace, is able to give peace to his aggressor. So begins the incarnation of the divine peace in the human personality, and the consequent gift of the divine peace to the world through a human I am.